How to start with a so utterly old-fashioned, 100-year-old topic, coming back to something which is, I think, now almost utterly forbidden, like iconology or something like that. The only thing maybe I could maybe draw your attention is that I will tell the story of artistic research the other way around, the opposite way around. This will be the clue, maybe, but the topic is utterly oldest-fashioned. It is so old-fashioned you can't be more old-fashioned than that, because it is on discourse on art, which is then in that context I will talk something about painting, very traditional, very conservative topic. But this course on images, utterly images, two-dimensional, not moving, in the art historical context in the age of the internet. And what I'm interested in is how the media affect thinking about topics. And I will very, very will now go back and glimpse back into the methods of the founder of iconology, Avi Warburg, and I show you how I think his pictorial media influenced his thinking and what that meant to us when Avi Warburg structured his material. And you can see there are three of his frames in the Warburg library in the Hellwegstraße, in front of the books in Hamburg. when he prepared for his papers, he used these frames, and in his writings he referred to these images as is only possible with text and figures, describing what is to be seen in detail and in its wholeness. But I guess that he prepared his publications with exactly these frames, easily using pins and woolen thread to work out his chains of pictorial evidence, that is to exemplify how image details cling together. For instance, as they do in his famous paper about the frescoes in the Palazzo Schifanoia in Ferrara that you may know. And I'll just show you briefly that chain of evidence without explaining much more. Perseus to the Egyptians, to the Arabs, to the Spain stone book, and to the man, mysterious man in the Palazzo Schifanoia. The meaning of this last figure, the solution to an image riddle, as he posed it, is constituted by his ingeniously far-fetched interlinkages of images, the journey of the pathos geste through space and time that Warburg became famous for. I think it was easy for Warburg to use pins and woolen thread to interconnect the items, the pictorial motifs that were the substance of his argument, an exercise that is nowadays extremely and remarkably difficult in the internet, and which is remarkably different from normal scholarly discourse. His plates supported arguments made up of chains of image details. The sheer materiality of photographs and frames caused problems of their own. And I quote Avi Warburg's scientific diary: "The regrouping of photoplates is tedious. Mass displacement within the photoplates. Pushing around frames with Freund. Difficulty. The placement of Duccio. The arrangement of plates in the hall causes unforeseen inner difficulties. Begun to cut out all the gods. These hindrances are nowadays relatively easy to overcome in the digital domain, what is my place of work. But what was left to do, to work in a similar fashion as Warburg did, was to solve the pointing and addressing problem, so to speak, reinventing the pin and thread to return to a situation where we once again could work like Warburg with material in the digital domain. What had to be invented in you was the hypertextual link, known in text culture as footnote or as cross-reference, but for the image and with the image. We did so, and as will be shown shortly, we did so mimicking an artistic strategy, which is my version of that story we are talking about. So I will very briefly show what our technical solution to this problem was or is. Our invention of the digital pictorial footnote needs pictures from an image repository. And in the current implementation, we choose Prometheus, which is the main place of getting images for the artistry in German-speaking country, with the biggest collection and best reputation. A web interface had to be programmed for this interlinkage, and our technology called Hyperimage then works with the material from Prometheus, forming the service meta image, yielding networks of image details readable in the web. So this is the overall architecture. There are images in some repository. There is an editor for the interlinkage, and then there is the World Wide Web in which you could watch and observe all the interlinkages. So having chosen images from Prometheus, from the Prometheus collection, as the core of an image-based argumentation, which looks like this. You have the Prometheus interface and put together an image collection. Users, and maybe you should remember maybe just three of the images that are there. It's connected to Velázquez. Users then switch to the hyperimage environment in which they work on the image corpus by marking the image details by hand in a sophisticated manner, zoomable, independent of the resolution, and interlinking these image details within the meta image editor. I'm going to show you a short screencast where you can see prepared image detail markers and the interlinkage of these image details. Two windows, on top Velázquez, on the bottom Picasso. There is one marking is made, and now the Picasso rectangles are linked to the Velázquez rectangles. That was one typical operation in that editor to observe places of interest, mark them with polygons or rectangles or whatever, and then interlink them by a drag and drop operation. And instead of a woolen thread, a pointer, that is the computer science notion, the pointer originating from the first image detail indicates the connection to the second. What is done physically by poking the photographs with sharp needles and connecting them with a thread has to be accomplished intellectually with a computer. Someone has to indicate manually the place and the form of the motifs of interest and has to connect them by a drag and drop operation. All the internal bookkeeping of addresses and pointers and polygons is done by the computer. The pointer, the hyperlink, replaces the woolen thread, and there is no limit to knitting a net of connections independent of spatial or temporal resources. Images, their details, text, web addresses, and groups of all of that can be interlinked and enriched by metadata. This structure then is used in two ways. It is firstly brought to the attention of people in a human-readable form via the web, and secondly is exploited by the machine to compile indexes of various sorts. The readable version is prepared by the machine. It is immediately publishable on any web server or to be inspected locally. Oh. So I have to improvise. That's okay for me. So, and I'll show you the human readable form. Here we have the two rectangles in the Velázquez, and if you click on them, you you arrive at the Picasso stuff. And the indexes look like this. You you start at some place where you want to see all the origins of linkages, and choose all the backtracking, and then get a visual list of all the origins of this link. So that's one of the links leading directly to the place where we have looked up the index. So we have indexes, lists of all incoming and outgoing links. The resemblances have to be observed by the human intellect. All the computer scientists I show our work are very disappointed that we don't do that automatically, but we know that it's impossible. It has to be done by the intellect, because no computer will ever be capable of doing so, even in this quite clear-cut example, Velázquez and Picasso. So now, to shorten things up, I would like to show you the artistic work which inspired us to do so. I'm not showing you the other examples, but the artistic work. And this is the work of the late Anna Oppermann, who herself worked with us in the last years of her life to work with her artistic strategy. And as you can see here, this is one image of an ensemble which is at the Galerie der Gegenwart in Hamburg. And what you can see here is that corner of the room where she placed all of the photo canvases and all the very small objects which make up her work. And what I can show you now is how it's possible to rebuild her artistic and aesthetic strategy of referencing her own images over and over again. And this is utterly the place where we learned that technology from, or have been inspired to do so. So for instance, if you go here to this photo canvas, it's then put up filling the screen. You go here, and there again she depicted other objects, in the end depicted one of the elementary objects, which she did very, very often. As you can see, if you use the image index, the backtracking, or image concordances, as you could tell it as well, you will see that there are very, very many places from where there are pictorial references to exactly this object. For instance, if you go to a very complicated situation like this one, you can see this object is around here with a really huge huge arrangement of objects. So this is the work from which we learned and have been inspired to develop a technical solution. For me, the interesting question, say in an iconology framework, is what is the meaning of a particular image within this sort of image docuverse? And I always try to stir up the art historians by imagining that meaning could be a collective action of observing and selection. So what happens if the image corpus is not fixed, as within that Oppermann example, if interlinking becomes a collective activity, explicit technical interlinking becomes a collective activity, the answer to this, I think, is waiting in the net. Meaning is being created by linking. The meaning of a term in the World Wide Web also is the place where it resides within its net of references. Niklas Luhmann told us about his Zettelkasten, which was to him what the World Wide Web is now for us. And I quote Luhmann: "Every node is an element that gains its qualities only by virtue of the net of references and cross-references in the system." End quote. For him, the node was the node. And quoting him again, contrary to the structure of updatable references, the importance of what is noted concretely is small. So it's not so important what is noted on the pieces of paper, but what's important is the web of references. This was following Philippe Alain Michaud, not very far from Warburg's methodology, and I quote him, the enigmatic formula iconology of the interspace Warburg used in his diary, an iconology that did not concern the meaning of the figures, but the manifold relations that they took on in a complex autonomous dispositive that could not be reduced to the order of the discourse, suggests that he thought of Mnemosyne being topographic from the beginning. End quote. Since the references are explicit in the web, a machine can extract this meaning as a ranked index of terms. The top ranks of that kind of index itself is being used much more frequent than the less well-ranked ones, reinforcing them as defining items. By that recursive and self-amplifying mechanism, meaning is constituted. This resonates very well with the term meaning or Sinn that Niklas Luhmann introduced into his theory. Meaning is the medium in which selections are made, events becoming actual instead of remaining virtual, triggering new selections to actualize virtualities. And emergence of meaning takes place in a similar fashion in language. Think of the net of actual and virtual personal selections as being laid out explicitly, and you arrive at something similar to the World Wide Web with its interlinked documents. So with explicitly interlinked image detail references, a new way of constituting meaning becomes possible. By analyzing the web of references, this is science fiction up to the moment, by analyzing that sort of web of references, it should be possible to get meaning that is personally and socially constructed and machine readable. Actually, this is not fundamentally different from the constitution of meaning in a society. Also, traditionally, the more important scholars had a bigger influence on the definitions of terms. By that, they became even more influential. But one difference will bring about new structures. What and who the most important and thus most influential nodes of the net are evolves and emerges then from the net itself. So iconology could turn into a social emergent phenomenon by this sort of document structures. By analysis of the web of pictorial references and of the activities of the users, it will be possible to find out what the manifold meanings of an image are, dynamically changing from person to person and from time to time, from place to place, or in its broadest sense, as the common meaning the masses gives to objects. We could, for instance, find out what stylistic differences users make, whether they follow the established epochs of art history. We could find out which ones are the central masterpieces of art history, which ones the most innovative, with the broadest scope of interrelations. Maybe it could even be possible to predict the art history's central interests. So what could be artistic research on images? What is the correspondence to artistic pictorial research? As I've shown to you, Anna Oppermann had a decisively artistic research methodology. She responded to motifs by motifs. She did so extensively that the medium of the book in the book age had to surrender, and new scientific computer-based methodologies have to be applied to just show the work in reproduction. Deviating from traditional methodologies, the notion of pictorial similarity comes back to scholarly research. Similarity. Following Foucault, similarity was, in modern times, I quote, no longer the form of knowledge, but rather the occasion of error, the danger of which one exposes oneself when one does not examine the obscure region of confusions. Quote end. Similarity instead of linear logical conclusion steps back into academic discourse and even becomes subject to mathematical network theoretical investigations. Since Wittgenstein introduced the term Familienähnlichkeit into philosophy as an analytical term, we observe an iconic turn of which the research I showed you is a part of. To react on images by images was generally artistic approach, and that obscure region of confusion as well. For instance, see besides Oppermann, Roy Lichtenstein in his mural with blue brushstroke from 1986. He quoted by depicting, you will recognize lots of other artistic works in this mural. His mural arrived to be included in one of the famous Edward Tufte's information visualization books, which you should know. You should know all of the Edward Tufte's books on visualization. So this is one double page of an Edward Tufte book where he unveils or cites another paper that unveils all the image relationships. So is Lichtenstein's technique, is Oppermann's artistic program scholarly research? Does image referral bridge the gap between art and science? Another page in the Tufte book. Is an IBM photocopying machine artwork? I'm not sure about that. What I'm sure about is that the techniques of visual thinking become more and more important also in scholarship, as visual media gain more and more momentum. And very traditional artistic research now influences academic endeavor. I'm not sure whether mixing of scholarship and artistry leads to anything reasonable, and we are talking and discussing this today and tomorrow. I have the impression that the relationship between art and science is more of the perturbation type, to come back to system theory again. And as we know, perturbation is extremely fruitful. University as ours, also full of perturbatory movement, maybe could be a nice place and a good place to discuss all of that. Thank you very much.
So, Sally, yes.
Yeah, thank you. That was absolutely not what you said it was when you started. I find it quite exciting, and I was thinking about two things. One, some of the artificial life experimentation, artistic artificial life experimentation I witnessed about 10 years ago, a piece by an American artist, I think his name was Liu, but it's not the Alan Liu everybody knows. I'll find it. But it's a piece where he used automated image recognition technologies to edit several video artworks. And I'll find them for you because I think you'll be very interested. They're extremely moving and quite disturbing because there is a coherence in the algorithmically imposed developments of the images, and yet it's something that no human cognition could attain. It's a bit like Merce Cunningham's choreographic sequences that integrate postures that no human would naturally perform simply because they were devised from choreographic software. So I find that really interesting. But then the other thing I wanted to mention was a beautiful piece of work by Étienne Souriau, the French aesthetic philosopher, which has just been republished, prefaced by Isabelle Stengers and Bruno Latour, and called Les modes techniques d'existence, which is Simondon did les modes d'existence techniques, and Souriau's is called Les modes d'existence, and it's about what he calls plural existentialism, as opposed to existential pluralism, as opposed to ontic pluralism. And to cut a long story very short, Souriau emphasizes the dynamics of, I'm caricaturing, almost prepositional structures, the conjunctive structures between entities as opposed to the ontologically entity-driven structures. So when we read a given situation, what he is looking at is the dynamics of the connectivity between the entities in that situation. And somehow I think there's a lot of kinship with what you're talking about. But there's a very beautiful article by Latour, which has been published in English and French, on this book of Souriau's. And it, there is a notion of the dynamics inherent to trying to grasp a system almost expurged of its content, but focusing on the dynamic interconnectivity that I think you you might like. Yeah, I will, with pleasure. Yeah, yeah. But thank you. That was wonderful.
Yeah. There was a conference on arts, humanities, and complex networks, two of them, one in Boston last year, one in Budapest this year, which is also a connecting point between different fields, because complexity, you could find complexity in all of those fields, in art and in science. Say this sheer, raw, structural aspect is common to both, and it shears away all content. And that's a really interesting new look at stuff, purged by all, say, notional tradition.
Yeah.
So what is an art historical epoch could be reformulated by observing how images interconnect, how images are used by people, what are their normal habits to group images.
Mm-hmm.
This brings about, say, a very, very abstract notion of epochs, for instance, or style.
Yeah.
But that could only be seen if you exploit mathematical methods of network analysis.
The Institut National de l'Audiovisuel in France, under when Bernard Stiegler was running the Atelier, they were developing a system. I think it was called SLAV. I can't remember what the acronym was, but it was a search and retrieval automated image recognition system for exploring INA's archives, which are substantial. From having been occupied, we were able to keep the archives. But Stiegler's, I think a lot of his theorizing on discretized knowledge systems and on the emergence of knowledge across manipulation of these different kinds of systems of meaning came through his work in the Inatec. Sorry, I'm raving on a bit. There is William Turner. He must be English, but he's been living in France for a long time. He wrote a book on hybrid intersubjectivities, and this was in the 90s. He was writing about a system called Leximap, which was an infometrics piece of software, and it was before web visualization techniques, it was to try and detect search patterns in very, very broad communities to see whether there was any possibility of anticipating on innovative paradigms arising within a community.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony was that innovative paradigms are by definition not predictable, because they're disruptive innovation. So they come from nowhere. They come from the periphery so far that they can't be accommodated in the initial setup. But Turner's reflection on this automated search and analysis activity is beautiful. And at the end, when he says how stupid we were, because of course we weren't going to be able to anticipate innovation. But we learned a lot of other things. It's an example of a failure, I guess, that proved to be extremely fruitful for the community. But
I'm wondering whether what you're describing is You know what it does? Sorry. What does it do to artistic practice? Because, you know, initially what you're describing is an, almost an art historical, iconological methodology supported or made possible by the technological system. So it's really an analytical tool for something that is happening in the world already.
Yes.
And, you know, in the case of the Oppermann works, you're providing an interface for reading those works in a different way. And I'm just wondering in how far the imagination that that possibility creates can actually impact on artistic work. You know, like technologies, like different technologies or media, because they are put into the world, then start to interest artists or change the way in which they look at what they've been doing until now. This is where this links to Jens's presentation earlier, where, you know, we're observing a situation in which a specific technology and the whole imaginary package that comes with it is brought into the world, and then artists take that up. And I'm wondering whether, you know, that part, that the possibility of actually infecting the world, the kind of the visual thinking with a system like yours, whether that is part of the planning or whether that comes as an accident.
That would come as an accident. So this is the story the other way around, as I told you before. So this is now something which came from art as a aesthetic strategy and went into, say, technological development. And it's an open question whether scholarship would then influence art. I don't know. The main question I had all the day was the other way around: is science really affected by art? And now you're asking the question if whether art is affected by scholarship, and I'm not sure at all. I still cling to the say differentiating hypothesis, and mainly expect that perturbation could take place. But looking again at the situation, Anna Oppermann did her work before the web was public, so she was, say, visionary, and it was in the air to work like that. It was in the air for Tim Berners-Lee to think of image docuverses, and it was up in the air for her and others to build up docuverses of interlinked.
She did interlinked these things in the 80s, didn't she?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, it was the time before the World War II. So her idea of interlinked documents was some sort of model, could have been a model for the world, but wasn't. It was totally apart. But I don't know. I don't know whether Tim Berners-Lee visited Documenta or Biennale and saw that. Well, I don't know.
I'm not sure whether you need it to come on with the work like that.
I wonder if I may ask.
Yes.
Thank you. That was extremely interesting. I found it quite revealing that you should have gone back to look at Warburg's actual technology, because he had a technology. The idea of actually stitching or poking a needle into an image and taking the thread to another image, this whole business of stitching together images, quite literally, was a performed technology. It was a way of making knowledge and constructing those constellations that had to be stitched in the way he did. Of course, there is one argument, I have called it a Dada epistemics. There is one argument that Dadaism formed the model through which he developed an art historical analytic So in a way, whether the scholarship came first and its impact on art, or whether art came and impacted on the scholar, is difficult. It's always in and you use the word docuverse, which led me to think again of the early Xanadu models.
Yes.
But I was wondering if something was not lost with that very antique Ariadne's thread that he was creating. The tangle that he created was the tangle of the semantic tangle, from which there is no escape in the end.
Yeah.
That one is constantly weaving and constantly unraveling in the hope of finding the kind of final constellation which explains it all. One never gets there.
No.
But the performed business of actually stitching is something lost in docuverse versions. I'm just wondering what your thoughts might have been.
Yeah, the docuverse turned out to be a read-only medium mostly. As we know, Tim Berners-Lee devised World Wide Web as with his Next machine as something which includes an editor as well. But it turned out that only very, very few weave and all the others read. Mm-hmm. And coming back to Warburg, that notion of a good neighborhood of his books and his library, that is lost completely as well.
Yes.
Because this is something very analog cloudy and ambiguous and always changing, and if you poke something, you nailed it.
Absolutely. And of course, Lex did mean a certain kind of reading and legibility, so there is a kind of hyper-legibility that's introduced, which takes away that murk, takes away that sense of having to go through the performance again of following the thread and deciding where to actually make the next stitch.
But it could become interesting once again if this actually becomes a social endeavor. Since we introduced this technology to the 10,000 users of Prometheus, and I hope at least 100 or 200 will use it, then it could be interesting to observe them and to look at different versions of those stitchings. Maybe this could be interesting and could bring back ambiguity and sliding notions and things like that.
Is there a question back there?
Yes. Do you also have the possibility to comment for the people who get observed what they have for more ideas for stitching images that you didn't stitch?
You would have to do that. You would have to do that commenting in a known project, at the moment.
Mm-hmm. So there's no annotation system.
It is an annotation system. You've seen the maybe you've seen the text at the right hand side,
yes.
And there is text popping up. If you touch an image motif, you can extensively annotate. And what I've left out was some students' work I did. which was to reformulate Foucault's comment on Velázquez, on the Las Meninas, which is not that easy to understand if you read it in this order of things, but if you really get pushed at the image details, he meant this is the group of persons, this is the very window where the light comes out, this is the frame, this is the one in the back of the room, then the reading becomes very different. I didn't show you that, but this was mostly, say, an annotation project, annotation of the Foucault annotation of the Velázquez painting.
I would like to pick up on what Sarat said, or how I understood it, that is the resistance of the material that gets lost when Warburg's threads get translated into algorithms, if you like, or a digital system, and I'm wondering whether there's not some other kind of grit and uncontrollability and resistances that you also find in the digital system.
Yes, if you actually do a project with this technology. You come to, mm-hmm. to limits of complexity, of categorical. You come to categorical problems. You have to decide rhetorically to decide what should a click on an image motif mean. What should a link mean? It's not predefined. So you make up a model, and you have to carry it through in order to let people understand what you did. But then you come definitely to an end at some place, and you think, okay, next time I would do it totally differently. So the border is more or less say complexity then, or the limits of complexity are displaced to bigger collections of items that are interconnected.
See, when Picasso came to do his commentaries on the Velázquez, so we have 64 variations on that painting. In the 64 variations, it's a completely open-ended system.
Yes.
With commentary and annotation on each one of elements of the Velázquez. I suppose I have that sort of open-endedness somewhere in mind, in contrast to the sort of legibility introduced with the system derived from Lex.
Yeah, it could be possible. It is definitely technically possible to have this as an open-ended collective endeavor, and to say calculate or compile sort of Google search ranking out of that. So what is what are the observed used interlinkages between image motifs, not just in one project but overall projects? Then you would have, say, an open situation as we have on the web with Google. All the connections of web pages are fixed at it in a time, but you get this dynamics and structure by exploiting huge amounts of interlinkages and doing that over time. But this is actually still science fiction. It's not built into HTML. This for me, it's an interesting question why Tim Berners-Lee did not put that into his HTML framework. He did all this very easy interlinkage of text chunks, but he did not think of images as objects whose details should be interlinked. So this has to be put on top of all of that, which hinders people doing it. And now we hope to have at least this group of 10,000 people using Prometheus to try what it means to be able to. But then that becomes dynamic.
And there's also lack in Google search. You can't scan your image by Velázquez and get out it is a Velázquez. You know what I mean? You have a Google search for images, but I can't put my image in the internet, in the search, and say, what is it?
Mm-hmm. Ah, okay, mm-hmm. similar images. Mm-hmm. There's the problem of similarity, but this could be, say, for a digital copy, this could be solved. You could formally decide what it is. You could formally decide what images are almost identical in a very narrow sense.
Yeah, but at the moment Google doesn't do
that. there is that Google Lab image search, which is astonishingly well for the first finding, and then drops to absurd findings. So this is one very interesting aspect of images that they are.
But that's because Google search is based on connotations and words.
Yeah, the normal image search is, but there is also a Google Lab version of query by image content where you put an image as the one as the search item, and you get other images not being done with text. But this is very very unstable, and it drops dramatically at some point.
But they're still developing that, huh, I think.
Yes, but the people are developing that since decades, so it's a very hard problem. It's a very hard problem, at least, right. Yeah.
At least they have all the funds in the world.
Yes, that's true. They have all the funds, and they did not solve right. the problem yet.
Yeah. Do you know in which kind of algorithm this is based? This comparison.
This Google. No, I don't. This I do not know, but I know that IBM Cubic search is based on patterns, on color, and on shape. Yeah, and this is you can look it up in the St. Petersburg Eremitage. It's implemented there. You can search through the image collection of the Eremitage by that, and it's again astonishingly weak. I would stick to Mitchell's notion of an image being analog. Mm-hmm. In a very deep sense. Mm-hmm. So,
what about biometrics?
Biometrics works. So we have one example, it's biometrics. And with Facebook, we get a totally new image at the moment. It now implodes or explodes in a way in Facebook. Facebook being, anyway, the biggest image collection in the world. It is the biggest place in the web for images. It's not Flickr, it's Facebook. And with the tagging of faces by people and of people, you get immediately a huge and really and it's really very scary imagination that in the next months we will have a network of interconnected images on the basis of biometrics. You're totally right, and this changes everything. This could be done algorithmically. And is done algorithmically, and we will see the effects of that in the next months.
Plus the genomics.
Plus genomics. Okay, that's true.
And there's even an app where you can have a exposition of yourself, your Facebook site. I don't know if you are familiar with. I don't know the name anymore, but you can have your face. All your Facebook images are shown in the exhibition. And you just enter a room, and it's like animated with the technique of the architecture presentations. And you go to your own exhibition, where you see images you posted, and at the end you see all the faces of all your friends, and they become your face.
Who is that?
I have to look up, and tomorrow I'll tell you, because it's really interesting.
It's very similar to an application that we found this week, which is making your own horror movie. You just have to look in, and it's a kind of serial killer going to your Facebook account and getting out all the images and screening in the film. So it's a real-time made movie, and then it's driving to your place and it's knocking at your door, and then the end line is this guy is next. We tried it, it was her sister. Right. And there are images and finding out even about the location, which is not indicated in the Facebook account, but building connections that it makes up a real horror movie in real time. It's an artist application, which was blocked by Facebook itself because it was considered as being counterproductive for internals.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. There's a wonderful UK artist called Graham Harwood.
Who was here yesterday?
Who was here yesterday? Oh, damn! I missed him. Who did a piece of work in 2006 called Net Monster, and I have a picture here. He has a very good explanation of the process, but basically it's a mix of compiling. I don't know how many images,
yeah,
thousands of images,
yes,
and terms, and it's just a beautiful, constantly evolving sort of a system. In a way, it's perhaps an artist rejoinder to some of the stuff that you're showing us.
Okay.
But it's nice; it just keeps growing.
Okay.
Graham Harwood.
Well, it's on the mongrel side.
Mongrel, yeah.